Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Sitting next to the heater, keeping nice and warm. It should turn itself off in a second if you can hear that kind of fan noise, if that's annoying. Chapter 25 of Anna Karenina. Not a lot of conversation around this one. The questions I asked you guys were these: what are the political references about in this chapter? And Nicholas is not in good shape. What are your predictions for his future? Nikolai and his friends sound like narrowed nicks, says Corsio. Socialists who tried to spread their ideas among the peasantry. Narodniks, Russian, were a politically conscious movement of the Russian middle class in the 1860s and 1870s, some of whom became involved in revolutionary agitation against Tsarism. Their ideology was known as Narodnichevstvo, from the Russian people or folk. So it sometimes translates to peopleism or populism. A common slogan among the Narodniks was going to the people. Though their movement achieved little in its own time, the Narodniks were in many ways the intellectual and political forebearers of the socialist revolutionaries who went on to greatly influence Russian history in the 20th century. It does seem like a little foreshadowing of that, doesn't it? Okay. It looks like it stemmed from about the 1840s. Marxist historian Eric Hobsbawm detected a Narodnik influence on a Bolshevist method. Lenin's Bolsheviks owe more than they have sometimes admitted to the experience and methods of the work of the Buonartist Narodnik tradition. Though Marxist materialism has done its best to establish an atmosphere of deliberate and extreme matter-of-factness and colourlessness, even in the cloak and dagger activities, which, as the popular name shows, tends to compensate for the extreme tension in which participants are involved by a certain amount of romanticism. Oh. There does seem to be a sort of a romanticism involved, doesn't there? Yeah. Romanticism. Movement in the arts and literature that originated in the 18th century, emphasizing its... I think that's a different meaning of the word. Alright. That's about as far down the politics rabbit hole as I want to go. But yeah, it did seem like a kind of a shadows of a later, even the communist sort of thing, the common good, whatever they say. But you know, as soon as we go down the politics road, I'm pretty in over my head. But I thought we'd touch on that because the chapter definitely did touch on it. I Am Norwegian said, having two Levins in dialogue at the same time made parts of this chapter difficult to pass for me. At least Nikolai and Konstantin are burned into my mind now. The political references, I don't really know... Sorry, this is I Am Norwegian's comment, by the way. I don't really know any more than what I learned reading The Brothers Karamazov. Nikolai and his buddy are the prophets and are the unpaid wages of the working class kind of communists. Probably the kind Kolya would have turned into if he never met Alyosha, or the kind Musov would have been if poor. At the time, like in The Brothers Karamazov, institutions and society were changing, growing more modern and progressive, but many, especially at the bottom, were living as they always had done. Nikolai wants to create a cooperative, a metal working factory commonly owned by its employees. There would be no profits, and presumably big decisions would happen democratically. Early in The Brothers Karamazov, Musov mentioned that he had met Proudhon in France as a point of pride. Proudhon was an anarchist and the father of mutualism. Some of his writings sound very similar to Nikolai's rhetoric here. These ideas were taking off like wildfire. Writing this reminded me of A Young Doctor's Notebook, a four-episode black comedy set during the Russian Revolution. It stars Daniel Radcliffe and John Hamm, and it's really good. This is a show on Netflix, by the way. if anyone's interested, says Swims to the Mumfishy. I have watched that show. It was pretty good. In the early 20th century, a young doctor arrives in a small Russian village around the time of the Russian Revolution to work in the local hospital. What year? Early 20th century, so 19-something. Cool. Yeah, that was a good show. Quite good. Good little mini-series. Worth a watch if you've got Netflix and some spare time. All right, that was all the conversation we had about that chapter. Only three little comments. Thank you to those who made a comment. Very much appreciated. Short chapter as well today, so this won't be a very long podcast. While I've gotcha, go and have a little read, if you want, of Bogan War and Peace. If you go to Amazon and look for Bogan War and Peace, it'll let you read the first few pages or the first chapter or two on the preview. So you can go and suss it out that way if you're interested. All right, chapter 26, Anna Karenina, goes like this. Next morning, Konstantin Levin left Moscow, and toward evening, he reached home. On his way back in the train, he talked to his fellow passengers about politics and the new railways and felt oppressed, just as in Moscow, by the confusion of the views expressed, by discontent with himself and a vague sense of shame. But when he got out of the train at his station and by the dim light from the station windows saw his one-eyed coachman, Ignat, with his coat collar turned up and his sledge with its carpet-lined back, his horses with their tied-up tails, and the harness with its rings and tassels, and when Ignat, while still putting the luggage into the sledge, began telling him the village news, how the contractor had come and Pava had carved, Levin felt that the confusion was beginning to clear away, and his shame and self-dissatisfaction to pass. He felt this at the mere sight of Ignat and the horses, but when he had put on the sheepskin coat that had been brought for him, and well wrapped up, had seated himself in the sledge and started homeward, turning over in his mind the orders he would give about the work on the estate, and as he watched the side horse, once a saddle horse, that he was himself and did not wish to be anywhere else. Sorry, what? I think I missed a line. And as he watched the side horse, once a saddle horse that had been overridden, a spirited animal from the Don, he saw what had befallen him in quite a different light. He felt that he was himself and did not wish to be anyone else. He only wished now to be better than he had been formerly. First of all, he decided that he would no longer hope for the exceptional happiness which marriage was to have given him, and consequently he would not understand the present as he had done. Secondly, he would never again allow himself to be carried away by passion, the repulsive memory of which had so tormented him when he was making up his mind to propose. Then, remembering his brother Nicholas, he determined that he would never allow himself to forget him again, but would watch over him, keep him in sight, and be ready to help when things went hard with him. And he felt that that would be soon. Then his brother's talk about communism, which he had taken lightly at the time, now made him think. He considered an entire change of economic conditions nonsense, but he had always felt the injustice of his superfluities compared with the peasant's poverty, and now decided, in order to feel himself quite justified, that though he had always worked hard and lived simply, he would in future work still more and allow himself still less luxury. And it all seemed to him so easy to carry out that he was in a pleasant reverie the whole way home, and it was with cheerful hopes for a new and better life that he reached his house toward 9 o'clock in the evening. A light fell on the snow-covered space in front of the house from the windows of the room of his old nurse, Agatha Mikhailovna, who now acted as his housekeeper. She had not yet gone to bed, and Kuzma, whom she had roused, came running out barefoot and still half asleep into the porch. Luska, a setter bitch, ran out too, almost throwing Kuzma off his feet, and whined and rubbed herself against Levin's knees, jumping up and wishing but not daring to put her front paws on his chest. "You have soon come back, sir," said Agatha Mikhailovna. "I was homesick, Agatha Mikhailovna. Visiting is all very well, but there is no place like home," he replied, and went into his study. A candle just brought in gradually lit up the study, and its familiar details became visible. The stag's horn, the bookshelves, the looking glass, the hot air aperture of the stove with its brass lid, which had long been in need of repair, his father's couch, the large table on which were an open volume, a broken ashtray, and an exercise book in his handwriting. When he saw all this, he was overcome by a momentary doubt of the possibility of starting a new life, of which he had been dreaming on his way. All these traces of his old life seemed to seize hold of him and say, "No, you will not escape us and will not be different, but will remain such as you have been, full of doubts, full of dissatisfaction with yourself, and of vain attempts at improvement followed by failures and continual hopes of your happiness, which has escaped you and is impossible for you." That was what the things said, but another voice within his soul was saying that one must not submit to the past, and that one can do anything with oneself. And obeying the latter voice, he went to the counter, where 2 36-pound dumbbells lay, and began doing gymnastic exercises with them to invigorate himself. He heard a creaking of steps at the door and hurriedly put down the dumbbells. His steward entered and said that the Lord be thanked, everything was all right, but that the buckwheat had burned in the new drying kiln. This news irritated Levin. The new kiln had been built and partly invented by him. The steward had always been against the new kiln, and now proclaimed with suppressed triumph that the buckwheat had got burnt. Levin felt quite certain that if it had been burnt, it was only because the precautions about which he had been given instructions over and over again had been neglected. He was vexed, and he reprimanded the steward. But the steward had one important and pleasant event to report. Pava, his best and most valuable cow, bought at the cattle show, had calved. "Kuzma, bring me my sheepskin, and you tell them to bring the lantern. I will go and have a look at her," he said to the steward. The sheds where the most valuable cattle were kept were just behind the house. Crossing the yard past the heap of snow by the lilac bush, he reached the shed. There was a warm, steaming smell of manure when the frozen door opened, and the cows, astonished at the unaccustomed light of the lantern, began moving on their clean straw. Levin saw the broad, smooth, black, mottled back of a Dutch cow. The bull, Burkut, with a ring through his nose, was lying down and almost rose up, but changed his mind and only snorted a couple of times as they passed by. The red beauty Pava, enormous as a hippopotamus, turned her back, hiding her calf from the newcomers and sniffing at it. Levin entered the stall and examined Pava, who, becoming excited, was about to low, but quietened down when Levin moved the calf toward her, and sighing heavily, began licking it with her rough tongue. The calf fumbled about, pushing its nose under its mother's belly and swinging its little tail. "Show a light there, Theodore, here," said Levin, examining the calf. "Like its mother," he said, "although the colour in its is its father's. Very fine, big-boned and deep-flanked. Vasily Fedorich, isn't she fine?" he said, turning to the steward and quite forgiving him for the buckwheat under the influence of his satisfaction about the calf. "Whom could she take after not to be good, Simon? The contractor came the day after you left. We shall have to employ him, Konstantin Dmitrich," said the steward. "I told you about the machine." This one question led Levin back to all the details of his farming, which was on a large and elaborate scale. He went straight from the cowshed to the office, and after talking things over with the steward and with Simon, the contractor, he returned to the house and went directly upstairs to the drawing room. And that is the end of chapter 26. All right, thank you very much for listening today. I'll see you tomorrow.